Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Daniel chapter 2, which I will entitle Nebuchadnezzar's Dream of a Four Metal Statue. This chapter has 49 verses, which seems like it's very long, but actually it's relatively easy, especially considering that it's in the book of Daniel. So we will begin now in Daniel 2, verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams that troubled him and sleep deserted him. Nebuchadnezzar ruled from 605 to 562, so that pinpoints our date. There is a problem. Daniel's course of study to be a Babylonian official was to last 3 years, but in verse 1 we have the time referred to as the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and that's when the events of chapter 2 happen. So how do we reconcile Daniel studying for 3 years, but it's only in the second year of his reign that all this stuff happened? We read about Daniel's course of study being 3 years in Daniel 1, verse 5. The king assigned them daily provisions from the royal food and from the wine that he drank. They were to be trained for 3 years, and at the end of that time they were to serve in the king's court. Well, the answer to that is the Babylonians didn't count the accession year in a king's reign. So Daniel studied when he got to Babylon in 605, 604, and 603. That's 3 years. Remember, a portion of a year counts for a whole year. Nebuchadnezzar ruled from 605, but we don't count 605 because of the accession year style of dating, or non-accession year. So Nebuchadnezzar began ruling his first full year in 604, so 604 and 603 make 2 years, and there's your reconciliation. Now, since Daniel finished studying in 603 and Nebuchadnezzar has this dream in 603, some say that it was soon after Daniel's three-year course of study that Nebuchadnezzar had his dream. Some say Nebuchadnezzar had the dream within the three-year course of study. It doesn't matter. Could be either way. Now, Nebuchadnezzar was troubled when he saw that dream. It says in verse 1, Nebuchadnezzar knew that this was no ordinary dream. And of course it was not, as we'll see. We go to verse 2. So the king gave orders to summon the diviner priest, mediums, sorcerers, and Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. And then they came and stood before the king. Now, we talked about the Chaldeans in chapter 1, the previous podcast, talking about the date. The late date liberals say that Daniel is using the word Chaldeans here to refer to sorcerers, and the word Chaldeans was not used as a sorcerer until the Maccabean period, 2nd century B.C., and we discussed the fact that there is a homonym in the Babylonian language that, when pronounced, could either be Chaldeans as a race or Chaldeans as a sorcerer, and here Daniel is using it as a sorcerer. So when we see Chaldeans, we need, when we read it in English, to decide whether it's sorcerers and soothsayers and mediums and diviner priests, or whether it's a race of people, the Babylonians. Here it's sorcerers, mediums, and so forth. You noticed how demonic all this is. That's who he had advising him. Servants of Satan. We go now to Daniel 2, verses 3 through 6. Picking up from the end of verse 2, when they came and stood before the king, verse 3, he said to them, the king said to the officials, or to the soothsayers, I have had a dream and am anxious to understand it. The Chaldeans spoke to the king, and the Holman Christian Study Bible puts a note here. Aramaic begins here. So now we're going to read in Aramaic if we were reading in the original language. And so the soothsayers say, may the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream. Now forever, of course, means a long time. They don't expect the king to live eternally. Olam can mean either a long time or eternity. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. The king replied to the Chaldeans, my word is final. If you don't tell me the dream and its interpretation, you will be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be made a garbage dump. Nebuchadnezzar was no pussycat. But if you make the dream and its interpretation known to me, you will receive gifts, a reward, and great honor from me. So make the dream and its interpretation known to me. Well, let's start with the fact that Aramaic begins here in Daniel 2, verse 4. It runs all the way to Daniel 7, verse 28. The Aramaic does. Why? There are a myriad of theories. I'm going to give you the simplest reason that I could find. Aramaic was the lingua franca of the period, so Daniel used Aramaic. Official decrees were in Aramaic, so all the empire could read the decrees and understand them. Well, that makes sense, but why the switch back to Hebrew in Daniel 7:28? Here's what the apologetics website evidenceunseen.com says. Whereas chapters 2 through 7 deal with the Gentile nations, chapters 8 through 12 are written in Hebrew, because these deal with Israel's fate under Gentile rulers. Now that makes sense. The Gentile nations would be interested in the world empire, so we'll write in Aramaic so they can understand that. And then the Jews need to understand what their situation is going to be, so Daniel writes in Hebrew. Now we have an interesting question. Why was Nebuchadnezzar asking his soothsayers to tell the dream as well as the interpretation, which is pretty much a preposterous request? Well, it could be because he didn't remember the dream. That happens sometimes. Maybe he had a sense of the dream, but he had only a vague remembrance of the details, and so he needs his soothsayers to tell him all the details. On the other hand, it could be that Nebuchadnezzar was just setting a high hurdle to make sure he could get a valid interpretation. Now, I just said this is a preposterous request, but perhaps Nebuchadnezzar was not asking too much. After all, Chaldeans made their living on their supposed ability to contact the gods. Soothsayers were supposed to be able to gain secrets from the spirit realm. And so Nebuchadnezzar says, do your jobs. Tell me what the dream was. Now, whether Nebuchadnezzar remembered the dream or not, we don't know. Doesn't matter. He wants results. And he says, if I don't get results, I'm going to turn your houses into a garbage dump. But worse than that, you will be torn limb for limb. And this is one possible way that could be done. Four trees are bent over at the top and tied together with a rope. And then under the tops of those trees, the victim is carried, and each of his limbs is tied by rope to each of the trees. Left arm to tree number one, right arm to tree number two, left leg to tree number three, and right leg to tree number four. The rope tying the trees together is then cut, the trees spring back to their natural position, and the victim's body is snapped into four pieces. Not a pleasant way to die. And so you see, the soothsayers are in one world of trouble here. And remember, Daniel is a member of this group of government officials. He's going to get torn limb from limb too if somebody doesn't tell Nebuchadnezzar what his dream was and the interpretation thereof. So we go to Daniel 2, verses 7 through 9. They, that's the soothsayers, the officials, answered a second time, may the king tell the dream to his servants, and we will give the interpretation. The king replied, I know for certain you are trying to gain some time, because you see that my word is final. In other words, the word about being torn limb from limb. If you don't tell me the dream, there is one decree for you. You have conspired to tell me something false or fraudulent until the situation changes. So tell me the dream, and I will know you can give me its interpretation. Nebuchadnezzar's suspicious, rightly so. They were stalling for time. And Nebuchadnezzar knew it. What was the ploy of the mediums and soothsayers? They want the situation to change. Now, how might that be? Well, the more that time passed, there was a bigger chance that, for example, Nebuchadnezzar could remember the dream and tell it himself, if indeed he had forgotten it. As time would pass, Nebuchadnezzar would forget the details and thus be unable to prove them wrong when they gave some cooked-up interpretation of the dream. After time passes, Nebuchadnezzar's passion would cool off. Maybe he would not be so final about his decree. If time passed, either the soothsayers might die naturally, or maybe the king might die, in which case the situation becomes moot. Or, as time passes, perhaps some other affair would come up and distract Nebuchadnezzar from worrying about this dream. But Nebuchadnezzar knows what they're doing. We go down to Daniel 2, verses 10 through 11. The Chaldeans answered the king, no one on earth can make known what the king requests. Consequently, no king, however great and powerful, has ever asked anything like this of any diviner priest, medium, or Chaldean. What the king is asking is so difficult that no one can make it known to him except the gods, whose dwelling is not with mortals. So what the Chaldeans are saying, the soothsayers are saying, they're admitting that only God can answer such a crazy request. And that's exactly what happened. God answered the request. Now, when the Chaldeans, the soothsayers, told Nebuchadnezzar that no one has ever asked anything like this, their strategy was to convince the king he was unreasonable. They did not embark upon a strategy of showing that they were competent, because they knew they couldn't answer the king's question. We go now to Daniel 2, verses 12 through 13. Because of this, the king became violently angry and gave orders to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. The decree was issued that the wise men were to be executed, and they searched for Daniel and his friends to execute them. Now we see Daniel and Daniel's friends, namely Azariah, Mishael, and Hananiah, were in a world of trouble. Now, this was convenient for Nebuchadnezzar. He was a new king. He had just taken over. This gave him a chance to clean the house of all the old advisors that might have been there under his father Nabopolassar. And that's a pragmatic reason, but the real reason was he was angry. Again, Nebuchadnezzar was no softy. We go now to Daniel 2, verses 14 through 16. Then Daniel responded with tact and discretion to Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, who had gone out to execute the wise men of Babylon. He, that's Daniel, asked Arioch, the king's officer, "Why is the decree from the king so harsh?" Then Arioch explained the situation to Daniel. So Daniel went and asked the king to give him some time so that he could give the king the interpretation. Notice in verse 14, Daniel responds with tact and discretion. He didn't panic. He kept his head, and that kept his head from being cut off, because he directly went to the king and said, "I believe I can get the interpretation, but I need some time." This crisis revealed Daniel's true character. He acted quickly, even though he wasn't the cause of the king's anger. And fortunately, the king implicitly gave Daniel some more time. So we go to Daniel 2, 17 through 18. Then Daniel went to his house and told his friends Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah about the matter. That's the same as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's their Babylonian names. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are the Jewish names. So Daniel went to the three friends, urging them to ask the God of heaven for mercy concerning this mystery, so Daniel and his friends would not be killed with the rest of Babylon's wise men. Now notice that the first thing Daniel did in this crisis, he sought prayer companions. He didn't try to pray alone. And I'll tell you, if you want an application here that'll stand good for the ages, when you get in trouble, you better find people to pray with you. That's just the way God works. Now, I have noticed that when people need prayer, oftentimes it's about something highly personal, like a health issue or a family relationship issue, and they don't tell anybody. And so nobody knows about it, and so nobody prays. It's a terrible catch-22. If you're in trouble, find somebody and say, "Pray for me, I need some help." Daniel 2:19, we continue. The mystery was then revealed to Daniel in a vision at night, and Daniel praised the God of heaven. Well, there you go, answer to prayer in a crisis situation. Now, this vision at night was either a dream at night, or maybe it was a waking vision at night. It doesn't really matter. But Daniel knows the dream, and he knows the interpretation. And notice, Daniel praises God for the answer. Daniel praised God. Another good application there. God gives you an answer. Don't forget God. Don't forget to praise him for it. So Daniel praised God, and we take it up in verses 20 through 23. He praised God and declared, "May the name of God be praised forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. He changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and establishes kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals the deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I offer thanks and praise to you, God of my fathers, because you have given me wisdom and power. And now you have let me know what we asked of you, for you have let us know the king's mystery." There's an old expression, knowledge is power. Well, God has all knowledge, and Daniel keeps attributing knowledge and wisdom to God, and the fact that God revealed that to Daniel, that wisdom and knowledge. In verse 21, Daniel says that God changes the times and seasons. God makes night turn into day. He makes winter turn into spring. All of this is done by God. It's not done by chance, as the heathen thought. In verse 23, Daniel says, "And now you have let me know what we asked of you." The "we" is Daniel and his three friends. Daniel had faith to believe what God had revealed to him was accurate, even before Daniel checked it out with Nebuchadnezzar. He didn't go to Nebuchadnezzar and say, "King, is this your dream?" Tell him. He just knew it was true. Well, that's not surprising. I imagine this vision was quite stark, quite revealing that Daniel had. So we go now to Daniel 2, verses 24 through 30. Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had assigned to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He, Daniel, came and said to Arioch, "Don't kill the wise men of Babylon. Bring me before the king, and I will give him the interpretation." Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said to him, "I have found a man among the Judean exiles who can let the king know the interpretation." The king said in reply to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, that's Daniel's Babylonian name, the prince of Bel, Babylonian pagan name. The king said in reply to Daniel, "Are you able to tell me the dream I had and its interpretation?" Daniel answered the king, "No wise man, medium, diviner, priest, or astrologer is able to make known to the king the mystery he asked about. But there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has let King Nebuchadnezzar know what will happen in the last days." Now you notice how Daniel sets this up. The servants of Satan, he doesn't call them that, but that's what they are, mediums, diviners, astrologers. The servants of Satan have failed, but God is bigger than them, and he can tell you what will happen in the last days. "Your dream and the visions that came into your mind as you lay in bed were these. Your Majesty, while you were in your bed, thoughts came to your mind about what will happen in the future. The revealer of mysteries has let you know what will happen. As for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but in order that the interpretation might be made known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind." Now, in verse 25, when Arioch, the captain of the guard, goes to the king, he says, "I have found a man who can answer your dream." Arioch is possibly trying to take credit for what Daniel is able to do. Maybe. Or maybe he's just stating a fact. Well, if he is trying to take credit, contrast that attitude to Daniel's humility. In verse 30, Daniel said, "This mystery has been revealed to me, not because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but so that the interpretation might be made known to the king." So Daniel says, "I don't have any more wisdom than anybody else." Very humble Daniel was. Now, Daniel says that Nebuchadnezzar is going to be made known by God what will happen in the last days. Now, that phrase, last days, of course, conjures up images of the end of the world, thanks to the eschatological futurism that has soaked the evangelical church. And I will point out to you that most often, last days does not mean the end of the world. It usually means the end of the Jewish age. Here, it means the last days of Nebuchadnezzar's empire. Actually, it does mean the last days of the Jewish kingdom, because when the fifth monarchy, the stone, comes, that's right at the end of the Jewish age, when the church is established. So I guess you could say last days here means the end of the Jewish age. But of course, from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view, it's the future of the Babylonian empire. And as it turns out, the world empires that succeeded Babylon. So the future to Nebuchadnezzar is latter days to him. And let me repeat, this is not talking about the end of the world. The fifth stone monarchy, which we'll read about in just a minute, is the establishment of Jesus' church, which did not happen at the end of the world. We go down to Daniel 2, verses 31 through 35. "My king, as you were watching, a colossal statue appeared." This is Daniel speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. "That statue, tall and dazzling, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was terrifying. The head of the statue was pure gold. Its chest and arms were silver. Its stomach and thighs were bronze. Its legs were iron, and its feet were partly iron and partly fired clay. As you were watching, a stone broke off without a hand touching it." Later on, we'll see it broke off from a mountain. "Struck the statue on its feet of iron and fired clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the fired clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were shattered and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. The wind carried them away, and not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." So the statue had four metals, and the statue was smashed by a stone. Notice that the value of the metals descended as you go from top to the bottom of the image. Gold goes to silver, goes to bronze, goes to iron. The metals are getting cheaper and cheaper as you go downward. What's the meaning of this? Well, I assume that it means that the kingdoms of this world are losing their grip. And let me give you a heads up on which kingdoms are being referred to here. The gold head, that's Babylon. The silver chest and arms, that's Medo-Persia. The stomach and thighs, which are bronze, that's Alexander the Great and his successor kingdoms. The legs are iron, that's the Roman Empire. And the feet, partly iron and partly clay, that's part of the Roman Empire. We'll talk about the Roman Empire a little later, but these are the four kingdoms being referred to here in this dream. So we go now to Daniel 2, verses 36 through 39. Daniel continues speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. "This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. Your Majesty, you are King of Kings. The God of Heaven has given you sovereignty, power, strength, and glory. Wherever people live, or wild animals, or birds of the air, he has handed them over to you and made you ruler over them all. You are the head of gold. After you, there will arise another kingdom inferior to yours, and then another, a third kingdom of bronze, which will rule the whole earth. Now, in verse 36, Daniel says, this was the dream. He gave the dream before the interpretation. That was smart, because as soon as Nebuchadnezzar heard that Daniel knew what the dream was, and we assume Nebuchadnezzar knew the dream, that's really going to give Daniel credibility in Nebuchadnezzar's eyes. I suspect Nebuchadnezzar is listening quite closely now. Now in verse 38, Nebuchadnezzar is said to be the head of gold. Babylon had more centralized power than all the other kingdoms, which were spread out further geographically, and so it makes sense to make a head gold, to make Babylon the head, because the head thinks and controls things from the head. Verse 39, after you, after Babylon, there will arise another kingdom. That, of course, is the silver kingdom of Medo-Persia. That kingdom lasted 220 years, approximately, from 550 to 530. 550 is when the Persians revolted from their Median overlords in the northern Iranian plateau, down to 530, when the Persian Empire expired, according to Wikipedia. Now, how is the silver kingdom, Persia or Medo-Persia, how is it inferior to Babylon? Here's some possible options. Inferior in power, inferior in perception and the way it's looked at, inferior in its culture, inferior in its military, maybe inferior in all of its aspects. Now, I do not know enough ancient history to have a feel for how Persia is inferior to Babylon. I'm assuming it's true. Now, we get down to the Bronze Kingdom in verse 39. This Bronze Kingdom, which will rule the whole earth, that is referring to Alexander the Great's Grecian Empire, the Macedonian Empire, from 336 to 323. That's only 13 years for Alexander, but his successors lasted from 323, when Alexander died, down to B.C. 30, when Cleopatra, the last of the Ptolemies, went down to the Romans, the last of the Ptolemies who ruled as an independent kingdom. Now, this kingdom of bronze is said to rule the whole earth. Now, that's significant because Alexander the Great's empire stretched further geographically than all the others, except, of course, the Stone Empire, which covered the whole world. Alexander the Great's empire covered Greece, Macedonia, Anatolia, present-day Turkey, the Levant, present-day Lebanon and Israel, and Syria, too, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Persia, some places in Central Asia like Bactria, present-day Afghanistan, Sogdiana. Wait, this was a huge kingdom. So Alexander plus his successors ruled about 316 years. Now remember, Daniel is speaking of this before it happened. He was a prophet. These are amazing prophecies. We go now to Daniel 2, verses 40 through 43, and we will look at the fourth kingdom. Daniel continues speaking to Nebuchadnezzar. A fourth kingdom will be as strong as iron, for iron crushes and shatters everything, and like iron that smashes, it will crush and smash all the others. You saw the feet and toes, partly of a potter's fired clay and partly of iron. It will be a divided kingdom, though some of the strength of iron will be in it. You saw the iron mixed with clay, and that the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly fired clay. Part of the kingdom will be strong, and part will be brittle. You saw the iron mixed with clay. The peoples will mix with one another, but will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with fired clay. Now, I have read enough of Roman history, or Western European history, to know that this description of the Roman Empire, the Iron Empire, is right on the money. The whole history is all about the barbarization of the Romans, how the Romans defended from the barbarians, how the barbarians came through the borders at the Danube River, and how they became part of the legions, and how sooner or later they actually became emperors themselves. And in verse 40, this fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, will be as strong as iron. Well, the Roman Empire is famous for its soldiers, its spirit of martial law, its military nature. For iron crushes and shatters everything. You don't want to mess with the Roman army. They lost sometimes, but they came back. In the wars with Carthage, Cana was the horrible defeat, and They came back from that. And so the Roman Empire, the Iron Kingdom, crushed and smashed all the others. I think that means all the others that were in its path. It can't refer to Babylon because Babylon's already gone down. Persia, actually, the Romans actually attacked part of Persia, the Sassanid Persians, different Persians than Cyrus the Great. And of course, the Romans smashed and crushed the successors to Alexander the Great. It could be all the others refers to all the other kingdoms that are around Rome, not necessarily all the other kingdoms that are in the statue. Now, in verse 41, Daniel says he sees the feet and toes, and then there's a comma. The toes are partly of a potter's fired clay and partly of iron, or does it mean the feet and toes, comma, the feet are partly clay and partly iron? I don't know. It's probably how you translate it, but I'm just going to assume it's the toes. It's just easier that way. Let's just think of the toes alternating. One toe is clay and one is iron. This symbolizes a divided kingdom, as Daniel says in verse 41. Now, how many toes do 2 feet have? 10. John Gill says that these 10 toes represent the 10 kingdoms in which the Western Empire was divided. And these 10 kingdoms are the same 10 horns of the sea beast. We know the sea beast is the Roman Empire in Revelation. Revelation 13:1 says this, "And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads. On his horns were 10 diadems." All right, so those are the constituent nations of the Roman Empire. Revelation 17:12-13, "The 10 horns you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom. They will receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour." They're constituent kings. They get their authority from the empire. They rule their subordinate kingdoms with authority from the empire. We read in Revelation 17:17, "For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his plan by having one purpose and to give their kingdom to the beast until God's words are accomplished." So the 10 kingdoms gave their kingdom to the beast. Now, what's the nature of these 10 kingdoms? Well, the nature is characterized by division. Well, first of all, we need to point out that this division can be described by 2 historical facts concerning the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire could be looked at as divided into 10 barbarous nations, or the division could refer to the famous division of the Roman Empire between the Western Roman Empire and the Eastern Roman Empire. The date's arbitrary, but let's just say 476, when the Western Roman Emperor no longer existed and the barbarian became, I think that was Odoacer, if I remember correctly, the Ostrogoth became the emperor without bothering to take up the title of emperor. Well, I'm going to assume the division is the 10 barbarous nations. Now, how does this show weakness? Well, because the nations are different nationalities, different religions, different languages. They were barbarian, actually, most of them. So what we have here is the world power starting with gold at the top of the statue with Babylon, and the world powers end up with dirt. And then they get smashed by a stone. So this is devolution, not evolution. The whole image was weak at the base, however impressive it was at the head, with that golden head at the base, clay and iron, weak. So Nebuchadnezzar saw in his vision the world of powers as an impressive, powerful man. But Daniel, 40 years later, saw the world powers as frightening, ugly beast. We'll see that as we go through the book. Now, verse 43 says this, "You saw the iron mixed with clay. The peoples will mix with one another, but will not hold together." This is referring to the constant problem of the integration of the barbarians with the original Roman citizens. Let me read you from Christian Think Tank, that's Glenn Miller. "A standard ploy of conquered Roman nations was to get the ladies to marry Roman citizen men, and therefore mingle the families into Roman power and privilege." That's standard history. In fact, the whole story of the fall of the Roman Empire is about the barbarization of the empire. It's talked about constantly by historians of the era, and so that fits perfectly. Daniel's vision fits absolutely perfectly. Now, the Maccabean late-date liberal theorists who say that Daniel was written in the 2nd century B.C., they say that Daniel is here referring to the marriage alliances of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. But Kylan Dillich respond and say, no, it's the people who are intermarrying, not the princes. Says the peoples will mix with one another. I don't know how strong an argument that is. But we do need to note that this mingling of the peoples, the clay and the iron, that mingling occurs while the kingdom was divided. In other words, while the kingdom was still in existence, it was internally divided. But if you take the late date theory and say the division is and the intermarriage is between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, Alexander's successors, that mingling was done by different kingdoms, not within one kingdom, as in Daniel's vision here, but within separate kingdoms. One more example of how liberals don't know what they're talking about. Now, a Christian think tank has a good quote on how iron and clay mixed together are weak. The empire that began as iron regressed to a state of clay mixed with iron. This mixture speaks of progressive weakness and deterioration. Two metals together form an alloy which may be stronger than either of the metals individually. But iron and clay cannot be mixed. If iron and clay are put into a crucible, heated to the melting point, and poured into a mold, when the pour has cooled, the iron and clay remain separate. They don't mix. The clay can be broken out, which leaves a weak casting. Weakness. We go now to Daniel 2, verses 44 through 45, and we will see a description of the fifth kingdom, the eternal kingdom, the kingdom of Christ. In the days of those kings, Daniel continues, talking to Nebuchadnezzar, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and this kingdom will not be left to another people. It will crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, but will itself endure forever. You saw a stone break off from the mountain without a hand touching it, and it crushed the iron, bronze, fired clay, silver, and gold. The great God has told the king what will happen in the future. The dream is true, and the interpretation certain. Now notice in verse 44, in the days of those kings, God will set up a kingdom that will not be destroyed. In the days of those kings, this tells us when God's fifth monarchy will be set up. It will be set up while one of the four kingdoms exists. The fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire. The fifth kingdom is set up during the times of the Roman Empire. So what does that tell us? That means it's the church, the fifth kingdom. The stone kingdom is the church in the days of those kings. That phrase automatically precludes a future millennial kingdom as fulfillment, because in the days of the Roman Empire, the stone will come and smash the Roman Empire. Now, you could posit a revived Roman Empire, and eschatological futurist, I will try not to use the pejorative phrase, prophecy nuts. They're constantly talking about a revived Roman Empire, and of course, you can't prove them wrong because it's the future, and so they sell $1 million worth of books, and everybody gets all hot and bothered. But notice, this kingdom is in the days of those kings, the last one of which was the Roman Empire. This kingdom will not be left to another people. In other words, nobody's going to conquer this fifth kingdom. It will crush all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it will endure forever. This is a description of God's eternal sovereign kingdom, which shall reign forever on earth. All world powers will be destroyed as the kingdom of God eventually conquers the earth. Now, you may have noticed that crushing these kingdoms refers to the conversion of those kingdoms. That's somewhat symbolic, and hyper-literalists get really upset about that. Well, let's look at how the futurists pervert this idea of the fifth kingdom. This, of course, is all in my humble opinion. Referring to the word crushed in verse 45, you saw a stone that crushed the iron. This is what the dispensationalist futurist Guzik says. This describes a single decisive event that shatters the image representing the glory of man's rule on earth. Since the church or the gospel have not, in a single decisive event, shattered the reign of human kingdoms, this event is still in the future. This isn't the gradual salvation of the world by the church, to which I respond, why not? What gives Mr. Guzik the right to say that this smashing of the fifth kingdom is a single decisive event? This is a dream. It's a vision. Are we to say that Nebuchadnezzar needed to stay asleep for thousands of years so that he can see that the crushing of the world powers refers to the gradual conversion of the world by the church? Well, of course not. It's a symbol. It happened quickly in the vision, even though it takes longer in real time. Now let's see what Heslop, another futurist, says. Smashing is not salvation. Crushing is not conversion. Destroying is not delivering, nor is pulverizing the same as purification. Gentlemen, it's in the dream. Your hyperliteral interpretation destroys the prophecy's meaning. It's talking about the establishment of the church, and you just completely jump over that like it doesn't matter in Daniel. The establishment of the church is a big deal. Let's don't slight it by constantly jumping to some mythical speculation of the future. Now, in verse 44, the kingdoms will be smashed. The problem with that is the Roman Empire is already gone, so the futurists say, well, this is a revived Roman Empire. Sheer speculation, folks. Not worthy of rejoinder, in my opinion. And then this stone, in verse 45, the futurists say that stone refers to the Messiah, not the church of the Messiah, but the Messiah himself, Jesus himself. The problem with that is you've got a vision that has four kingdoms in it, four kingdoms in the stone statue, and the fifth referent is all of a sudden not a kingdom, but the individual Messiah? I don't think so. We go to Daniel 2, verses 46 through 49, and we will finish this chapter. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell down, paid homage to Daniel, and gave orders to present an offering and incense to him. The king said to Daniel, "Your God is indeed God of gods, Lord of kings, and a revealer of mysteries, since you were able to reveal this mystery." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many generous gifts. He made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and chief governor over all the wise men of Babylon. At Daniel's request, the king appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego to manage the province of Babylon. But Daniel remained at the king's court. Now, the first thing we see in verse 46, what an amazing thing it is for the king, the emperor, to fall down before Daniel, to fall down prostrate before a Hebrew slave who was scheduled for execution. Nebuchadnezzar paid homage to Daniel. Some people say that maybe he offered oblation. He did offer incense. Maybe that's offering to Daniel as a god. Maybe not. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar wasn't offering religious worship to Daniel. The text is silent as to whether Daniel accepted the homage. I think this is personal respect, not worship, because Daniel would never have accepted worship as a god. And so Nebuchadnezzar, the pagan god, confesses that God is God of gods. Doesn't say Yahweh, but he does say God. I'm not sure which Hebrew word for God is used there, but it's not Yahweh. Your God is indeed God of gods. In other words, he's worshipped by all the other gods because he's above all the other gods. He's not really worshipped by the other gods, but he's over all the other gods. He is the Lord of kings. He's in charge of all kings, revealer of mysteries. So Nebuchadnezzar is given a lot of praise to the true God, even though he himself is a pagan. And so Daniel gets promoted. He's governor of Babylon. Then Daniel requested Nebuchadnezzar to put his three friends out into the province of Babylon to manage the province, and Daniel remained at the capital city of Babylon. Daniel wanted all the glory to go to God, and it sure did when Nebuchadnezzar started talking about God being God of gods. Daniel was a humble man. He didn't take glory for himself. And as a result, God got glory out of the mouth of a pagan. Now notice that Daniel looked out after his three friends. They were his prayer partners, remember? They prayed for the dream interpretation to be manifested, and it was. And so Daniel rewards them. And so God has taken degraded exiles scheduled for execution and has made them big shots in the kingdom of Babylon. And on that happy note, we are finished with Daniel 2, and we are now prepared to go to Daniel 3. Chapter 3, I will entitle Nebuchadnezzar's Golden Image and the Fiery Furnace. I hope you stay tuned with me for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.